Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 105, recorded Thursday, May 30th, 2013. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It is more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: traveling in Spain and the return of the hotel lobby. Well, I'm coming to you after a long break from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois. No, I did not fall off the face of the earth, though I've felt like I've been clinging to the edge at times. I started writing this episode in April, and then work got in the way, and then actually the weather got nice, and I pulled my bike out, and here we are, you know, one day before the end of May. I have been on the road just about every week since the last episode, but it's not as bad as it sounds. 2 days after I posted the last episode, I headed out to Spain with the family for spring break. It was 10 days split between Madrid and Barcelona. Now, the weather wasn't great, really, until the last couple of days. It was mostly rainy and about 10 degrees cooler than what we had packed for, which was Marvy. But I tell you, it beat the occasional snow showers that were in Chicago at that same time. Coming back, I headed back out to Portland, Oregon to wrap up some things out there. And then, you know, since then, I've really been traveling weekly down to New Orleans. I did do a day trip to Cleveland in the middle of that, which, you know, gave me a quick reminder that there are worse places to be traveling to than Portland or New Orleans. And though it may not seem so, you know, kind of the weather was kind of similar. You know, Portland, 58 degrees in rain, New Orleans, 78 degrees in rain. Though I think the New Orleans rain does seem to have a little bit more oomph behind it. But, I don't know, it hasn't been, you know, Gulf storms that delayed, you know, two of my flights home by over 2 hours. The delay on an American flight was caused by rain. Chicago was being pounded by, I don't know, like 5 to 7 inches of rain in that day. Rivers and roads were flooding. And my only complaint was that American showed that flight was on time until an hour before departure. And of course, we all know you're supposed to be at the airport an hour before departure. And, you know, I mean, given the delays that had gone on in O'Hare that entire day, I mean, you can't tell me that they didn't know way earlier in the day that there was going to be a delay. So instead, I show up, I get through security, boom, they drop the delay on. And now I got to sit around in New Orleans Airport, which I'll tell you is a surprisingly dumpy airport. Or at least, you know, Concourse C, where American goes off of. And so now I get to, you know, sit around for another 2.5 hours. Now, the 2.5 hour delay on United 2 weeks later, I'll tell you, that one had a much weaker excuse. The plane started the day in Denver, where it was delayed by a spring snowstorm. And then the delays just cascaded through the day. Denver to St. Louis to Chicago to New Orleans, back to Chicago. I mean, you know, United couldn't scrounge up a plane somewhere to stop that cascade. Well, I don't know, perhaps the United could, but United doesn't run the Chicago to New Orleans service. It's run by GoJet, an 8 or 9 year old regional jet company that subs for United and Delta. I mean, United has 706 jets, GoJet has 66, which kind of explains the day-long cascade. Now, United did start sending delay notices earlier in the day than American did, but they all came with the caveat that, oh yeah, we could have a delay, but you still need to be at the gate at the original time, just in case. A 1 hour delay cascaded into a 2 hour delay. It kind of felt a little bit like Groundhog Day from, you know, the 2 weeks prior. I mean, the only consolation was that the food choices are much better in the D concourse of New Orleans Airport. I had a nice Boudin Blanc and a big Abita beer. My waitress told me that I could take my beer to the gate if I wanted to. I looked at it, it was in a plastic cup. I mean, of course, it's in New Orleans. Why wouldn't I get served in a go cup? She said most people did that, made them feel more comfortable that they wouldn't miss their flight, but you had to make sure you finished it before you got on the plane. It was right about then that I got yet another delay notice for United. The waitress was looking to close up. I packed up my kit, my PC, and stuff like that. and headed out to the gate with a fresh beer. You know, you never can be too careful. So following up, I got to fess up to something that those of you who follow me on Twitter already know. I am one of those who bitch tweets about flight delays. I mean, I get frustrated, and instead of taking it out on the gate agents, which we all know is wrong, I wind the Twitter sphere, which means I take it out instead on all of my followers. Now, I recognize that this too is wrong. People don't follow me to get some whinge stream, so, you know, I'm working hard to stop. I don't know, I think I'm going to need to carry a stress ball or something this summer. Now, in my flight delay bitch tweets, I typically sort of at-name the airline, United and American in these past weeks, which nowadays tends to generate a tweet back within a couple of minutes. I mean, I guess this is nice, but I got to tell you, it's typically meaningless. I mean, the usual response asks me to direct message, DM, them with my confirmation number, which when it first started, I did. You're really hoping that they could tell me something that the gate agent couldn't, though I'm not quite sure what I was expecting, given that the gate agent is right there in front of me, and the tweet wranglers are probably in Manila or Chennai. I don't know, maybe I was expecting a bit more information, or, I don't know, some deeper insight into the cause of the delay, a better forecast of the actual departure time, rather than sort of the rolling 60-minute delay that never ends. No, but no, I didn't get any of that. Just multiple versions of, we're really sorry. No, we're really, really sorry, which actually is more frustrating than if they just didn't respond at all. I know they're trying, but I'm not sure that this is really an effective social media strategy. Trying to work my way through all these flight delays, I found the website FlightAware just invaluable. I mean, it provides real-time flight tracking information, which is critical if you're trying to figure out how real the posted flight delay is. Now, before I found FlightAware, my usual drill would be to work my way up to the gate agent, smile, and ask nicely if the inbound flight was in the air yet. If they had time, which is a growing rarity, they'd look it up, you know, nope, still loading, which means the posted delay is going to grow. You know, they're always too optimistic. They don't want you pestering them to transfer your ticket to another carrier, so they're always sort of short in the delay. FlightAware has all that information. Put in the flight number and it gives the current status and scheduled arrival time. Hasn't left yet? Hit the inbound flight link, and now you get the information you used to have to beg the gate agent for. Is the inbound equipment in the air, and when is it scheduled to arrive? Keep hitting that inbound flight link, and you can page back, you know, through the day to figure out where your schedule came off the rails. I mean, that's how I found out that my United New Orleans to O'Hare flight delay had started actually in that morning in Denver. FlightAware, highly recommended. A couple of weeks back, I walked up to American's status security line in O'Hare for one of these flights down to New Orleans, and I noticed they had completely reconfigured it. I mean, they'd quadrupled the amount of line space for pre-check people. Basically, they had just swapped the TSA pre-check and non-pre-check lines. I mean, it tells you how many people are willing to trade privacy for convenience. And by the way, I'm enthusiastically one of them. Though, you know, it's funny, you get caught short now, or at least I do, when having to go back to a non-pre-check airport. Now, for a while, I was doing nothing but pre-check airports. O'Hare, Portland, even when I flew through Cleveland. So on my first flight back from New Orleans, I completely booted it. I left my laptop and my backpack, kept stuff in my pockets going through the full body scanner. I got to tell you, I was a mess. I mean, luckily it was the middle of the day and hardly anybody was going through the security lines, so my cluelessness, you know, really didn't hassle anybody. I apologized to the TSA screeners. I told them, really, I said, guys, this is my first non-pre-check line in over a month. And actually, they got it. They were very reasonable about it. They said they were hoping that they get, you know, the pre-check shows up there soon. I mean, I tell you, as I've said before, even the TSA folks like the pre-check. And the mailbag, the Travel Commons mailbag, has filled up nicely since the last episode, or the fact that it's been 2 months since the last episode has let it fill up, you know, more so. I haven't taken the time to kind of figure out the root cause on that one. Anyhow, Nick Gassman, a longtime listener, listens to the podcast while he swims, which is great. Cuts the boredom, he says. You know, I listen to podcasts while I bike. Anyhow, Nick recently caught up with episode 103 from January, and commenting on the segment about all the different size of tablets, Nick writes, you know, I don't see the problem making calls on large phones or tablets. It's so easy and cheap to pair a Bluetooth headset to make a call. You know, you also see people at airports making FaceTime calls on iPads and Skype on the Nexus. Now, the issue seems to be holding it to your head rather than using it for calls. Absolutely, Nick. And Nick follows up. He says, I was interested in your review of apps. Do you use any of the airline apps? How about checking in and boarding passes? Have you used Apple's Passbook at all? Well, actually, Nick, I use all the airline apps, United, American, Southwest, Delta, mainly because, you know, now that they've got a couple of design cycles, a couple of iterations behind them, they've gotten a lot better. And actually, it seems to be easier and quicker to check in on a mobile app now than on the website. And actually, I do use Apple's Passbook to store the boarding passes. I like the quick access from the iPhone lock screen. You have basically one swipe and you're, boom, laying that boarding pass on the TSA reader. So, you know, absolutely, I use all that stuff all the time. Actually, you know, and I guess finally, the Southwest app. I mean, if you haven't paid the extra freight for either Business Select or to guarantee a list, then, you know, you're doing that 24-hour countdown so you can get a good place in the boarding line. And I've just found actually that the mobile app is the best way to use is the best way to get that. Dan Gradwald corrected my assumption in the last episode that a Delta MD-80 out of Minneapolis was an old hush-kitted Northwest DC-9, the ones that I used to hate when I lived in the Detroit area. He writes, Northwest's MD-80s were retired in 2000, thank God, and the DC-9s, amazing that those are still flying, fly out of Atlanta, so there's none in Minneapolis. So I suspect that you are on a former Delta MD-88, which are very reliable. I'm on them all the time. Dan also says, I totally agree with you on the TSA's knife policy. Just adopt it and don't make a big rollout with it. Nobody is going to take down a 767 with a penknife. Ken Oakle wrote in to ask about any recent experience with CATSA, the Canadian version of the TSA. Boy, you know, given the bad rap and the bad sort of brand identity of the TSA, you would think that anybody else would call their transportation security arm. They'd pick anything else other than TSA. So it amazes me that we've got Canadian TSA. Well, anyhow, Ken's heading up there probably about now to do some training. I think actually the last time I flew out of Canada was when my wife and I spent a long weekend in Toronto, and we woke up to the CBC talking about the second outbreak of SARS in Canada. I think that news crowded out any observation I had about airport security, and it was a really long time ago. But if any of you have some thoughts to pass along to Ken, I'll put a link to his website in the show notes. So thanks everybody for writing in, and as always, if you have any travel observations, questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along. As always, the email address comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. Use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. Post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or as always, you can post them right on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is traveling in Spain. At the end of March, my wife, daughter, and I met up with another family from the Chicago area for spring break in Madrid and Barcelona, or Barcelona, as the natives would say. The weather was slightly marginal. We were carrying umbrellas as a defensive measure for all but the last day or so in Barcelona. But I got to tell you, we had a great time and we're already looking forward to going back again. Now, I'm not going to tell you what to see. I'll leave that to my friend Chris Christensen and his Amateur Traveler podcast. Instead, I want to talk a bit about how we did it. It started way before we left when we were looking for accommodations. A few years ago, the search for a place to stay would have been very similar to the search for flights. Look at the awards point balances for each chain, Marriott, Hilton, Starwood, and start cycling through their websites. Now, we did a little bit of that. Our flight from Chicago to Madrid had us overnighting at Heathrow, so we burned through some frequent sleeper points at the Heathrow Marriott. But I got to tell you, for the past few vacations, we've moved from hotel rooms to vacation rentals. Now, once you move as a family from one to two hotel rooms, the economics for vacation rentals start making all sorts of sense, even without factoring in the savings from, say, being able to make your own coffee or your own breakfast. And there's all sorts of non-price benefits for things like having more than one room so you don't spend all your time sitting on your bed. However, booking a vacation rental place still isn't quite the seamless experience that you'd like it to be. Now, we booked what looked to be a great place in the Gothic Quarter of Barcelona. It was like right next to the Picasso Museum. Once we arrived, we were to call this phone number and someone would meet us at the property with the key. Seemed easy enough, but you can probably tell from the tone of my voice and the fact that I've actually put it in the podcast that it didn't quite work out that way. We get off the train from Madrid, ring the number. Oh no, we no longer handle that property. You need to ring this number. Okay, we ring that number. Do you have a confirmation number from our email? Yeah, here it is. No, that can't be it. All of our confirmation numbers start with a Z. You see where this was going. I mean, it took us 30 minutes, half a dozen phone calls, and me starting to do sort of the ugly American thing, raising my voice and really punching up my Chicago accent, before we finally got people to really sort of dig and get us connected with the owner of the apartment, who, once we called him, he said, "God, I've been waiting for you. What happened?" And I told him the story, and he apologized profusely, saying that he had told the vacation rental company 6 months ago that he had dropped that property manager and that he was managing it himself. Not quite the smooth check-in experience that you'd like. Now, 20 minutes later, he meets us at the apartment. It was a great place. Fit two families, perfect neighborhood. You know, it was what we really wanted. But now we had one last hurdle, and that was to pay. Now, we did know, so we had a preview of coming distractions here, that the owner wanted to be paid in cash. I mean, it's Spain. What can you say? So, you know, the prior 3 days, I mean, all the four adults, we'd been maxing out our ATM limits to amass enough euros, enough paper euros. I don't know, it would have been a bit easier and safer, I think, if he'd taken, if not a credit card, then at least a PayPal transfer. Now, before we left for Spain, we also decided to book a few, I call them cornerstone activities. Just things that you kind of set a stake in the ground and you can plan around. So we had a market food tour in Madrid, a cooking class in Barcelona, you know, a wine tour in Priorat. Now, I got to tell you, this is a big change for me. I mean, I used to run as far as possible from any sort of structure in my vacations. I mean, I got to tell you, one of the best trips my wife and I took was driving through Tuscany without an itinerary or a reservation, just a Michelin Red Guide. I mean, this was pre-internet, which and pre-mobile, which we would pull out whenever we got to a town that we decided to stop in for the night and, you know, find a hotel. You know, when we went to Vietnam a few years back, I booked the entire trip before we left. I mean, you needed to, or at least I felt I needed to with the family, and there was no way I was figuring out the Vietnamese language. And in that had included some private tours, a drive through Saigon, some temple trips, a night on a junk in Ha Long Bay. And I found that instead of feeling that I was sort of choking off the spontaneity, I felt instead like we got to see things we would never have found if we sort of had spontaneously landed in the middle of Saigon on our own. And I also found that it got us up the learning curve quicker. You know, I mean, having somebody, you know, show you the ropes, kind of, you know, kind of laying out the structure of the city, rather than having to sort of pick that up by osmosis, we just, I don't know, we got the hang of things quicker. So along those lines, I booked a food tour of Madrid's markets on our first evening in Madrid. Now, this solved a few problems. I mean, it helped keep us awake that first night, which is always a key to fighting jet lag. It had us walking through some of the neighborhoods of central Madrid, so we started to get our bearings, and it fed us, so we didn't have to figure out a restaurant our first night. You know, but if the vacation rental industry is a bit unstructured, the local tour operating business is a complete grab-all. I mean, TripAdvisor can be some help in avoiding lousy tour operators, but I don't think it's any good for search and discovery, finding that good person. So I ended up using the same method I used for finding people in Vietnam. I just sent emails to everyone I knew who I thought might know something about where we were going, Spain in this case. Now, a former employee of mine who now has got a new career, his second career, or maybe his third career, is he distributes wine and a lot of Spanish wine in Chicago. So he ended up connecting me with a wine tour outfit run by an American woman and a French woman, and they took us on a great day tour out to Priorat. And Craig Martin of the Indie Travel Podcast is now beginning to assemble a set of reviews for tour operators on his site, and he pointed me in the direction of an American woman who lives in Madrid and is doing food tour. So we ended up booking her tour, and Lauren took us through two food markets, did a comparative tasting of Iberian hams, got me drinking Spanish sweet vermouth, which I would have never ordered on my own, and basically got us, you know, the equivalent of what would have been a couple of days of experiences in what, you know, could have been just sort of a wasted night. Now, I'll put a link to Craig's interview with Lauren in the show notes, as well as links to her food tour site and the wine tour websites. Well, anyhow, all of this coordination requires communication, which in this day and age assumes a mobile phone, which can get expensive real fast if you're roaming on your U.S. plan. Just working my way through all the calls to get the Barcelona rental would have been easily $100. So again, I actually did a bit of pre-work, which in this case involved getting AT&T to unlock my old iPhone 4. And then once on the ground in Madrid, my first stop was to a mobile phone store to buy a prepaid SIM card. Now, we were staying in Madrid just off of Puerta del Sol, which is sort of a very popular shopping locale. Just about every mobile carrier had a shop there on Puerta del Sol. I ended up going to the Orange store, which, by the way, was the first one I hit. And it actually was also the carrier that Craig Martin recommended to me. And so €15, I got a card and a weekly plan that included 50 text messages and free data. And the Orange guy, you know, clipped down that full-size SIM so it would fit in my iPhone. It was absolutely a lifesaver and just smoothed over the time between being able to give people a local number as well as having the unlimited data to, you know, be able to just run a map, just run Google Maps without counting megabytes, which I normally end up doing with the AT&T data plan, global data plan. You know, being able to not worry about that, it was absolutely worth twice the €15. You know, it's funny, I was thinking about this. 20 years ago, you know, going over to Europe would have meant booking hotels through Telex, calling up our friends for tour advice, and making sure we were in a decent-sized town by mid-morning so we could cash our traveler's checks. For some reason, other than, you know, a couple of tweaks about method, it just doesn't feel all that different. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is return to the hotel lobby. Now, I remember many years ago being dropped off by a taxi at what purported to be the Royalton Hotel in New York. Now, the Royalton was the latest hip, cool, and edgy hotel from Ian Schrager, and a colleague of mine had insisted that we stay there. So I get out of the cab. It's late. It's raining. I'm in the middle of Manhattan. The place doesn't look like a hotel. I guess that was the point. It wouldn't have been hip, cool, or edgy if it had looked like an Embassy Suites. Now, there's a little plaque to the right of the door that says Royalton, so I trust the cabbie and I trundle up the stairs. I walk in the door. It's dark. There's some sort of bass-heavy house music thumping away, and the couches in front of me are full of people drinking and, I don't know, sort of general sort of pre-hookup positioning. I check the dress again. Nope, this is the right place. I see a woman at a desk at the other end of the room. Perhaps that's the front desk. So I trundle down. Nope, she's the hostess. I had passed the front desk. It had been tucked into the hallway wall halfway back to the door. The Royalton, in my mind, the Royalton was kind of emblematic of the idea that the traditional hotel lobby was a complete waste of expensive floor space, a revenue dead zone. So you saw places like the Royalton convert their lobbies into nightclubs, while budget chains just downsized them to oblivion, basically making them just a couple of chairs across from the check-in desk. But soon after hotels were downsizing their lobbies, companies were downsizing their real estate. So, you know, companies like IBM kicked people out of their offices, told them to telecommute, and saved millions in real estate cost. However, for all the advances in instant messaging and desktop video conferencing, people still want to meet face-to-face. And if you're both working out of home, where do you do it? Starbucks was, and I don't know, really still is, the default answer for the casual sort of quick flyby meeting. But as they've shut down underperforming stores and shrunk the footprint of others, I got to tell you, Starbucks are becoming less ideal. And I don't know, at some point, you get tired of shouting over the din of the steam coming out of the milk frother. Which gets me thinking again about hotel lobbies. Now, in Portland, I was staying at the Hotel Monaco downtown, and I got to tell you, I really enjoyed their lobby. It wasn't an extension of the restaurant or, you know, kind of tacked onto the front desk. It was its own space with couches and chairs that weren't bolted to the floor. So you could actually slide them around and have a conversation with somebody. In the same way, I like the lobby at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York. I mean, the furniture is not all pointed outward to watch the passing parade of people checking in. It's arrayed so you can talk to someone face to face. Now, some of the newer Marriott courtyards seem to be reinvesting in lobbies, but I don't know, with the big screen showing the weather forecasts and news headlines and a row of PCs, I'm not sure if they're, I don't know if they're trying to, you know, provide a conversation place or just, you know, a different take on a Kinko's. But then again, the last Marriott courtyard I was in had a Starbucks prominently displayed in the middle of the lobby. So, I don't know, maybe we've just taken this whole meeting place search thing and just one big circle. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 105. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. I gotta admit, I'm not quite sure what the bridge music is yet. I didn't have time to pick it out before the recording, although you would have thought after 2 months I would have figured this out. I got it. I'm sorry. So I'll end up be, I don't know, I'll be spinning the big dial during post-production. If you liked something, though, check out the show notes for the links. I always link up to the websites for the artists. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. M. Peacock on Twitter. There's always the Travel Commons wall on Facebook. Or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to take a couple of minutes and send in an email, tweets, and post comments on the website. I really appreciate it. And thanks to everyone for kind of hanging in there while I took the extended 2 month break between episodes. I'll try and be a little quicker in getting the next episode out. But until then, take care, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Home alone, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind. The warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling,